We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We're doomed, we're saved. Now more than 2 years on the air exploring the BioRevolution. It's been quite a journey, Izzy. Welcome.
Hello.
Today, you are in Berlin, I am in Frankfurt, and we'll be discussing the future of medicine, trends, technologies, and skills. I guess by now, for us and our listeners, it's pretty obvious that in the wake of the BioRevolution, the future of medicine will look quite different from what we knew in the past and what we know right now. One quote you brought today as a door opener for our episode comes pretty much from the past, right?
Yeah, it does. And it comes from one of the founding fathers of the United States, who also was an inventor, scientist, writer, so more of a holistic personality than we have today, Benjamin Franklin, who said, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," which is something that, I mean, will be leading towards the future of medicine, but also has already been recognized in the past that if you can prevent disease, it's much better than to treat a disease once it's occurred.
So you not only brought the Franklin quote, but something a little bit more contemporary, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I also brought a quote from Eric Topole, who is a scientist, but also a writer. He wrote the book Deep Medicine on how AI will shape medicine. And he brought a nice quote that brings together a little bit this technological aspect of the future of medicine with more of the skill aspect. And he says, eventually doctors will adopt AI and algorithms as their work partners. This leveling of the medical knowledge landscape will ultimately lead to a new premium to find and train doctors who have the highest level of emotional intelligence, which I think is actually a quite nice view towards the future. So maybe AI can take over a lot of the, let's say, daily dry business of being a doctor, but connecting with patients is still the business of an emotionally intelligent human being.
The personalized medicine and the emotional intelligence part, I guess we'll get to that at the end of this episode a little bit more in depth. But let's start with kind of a summary where all the construction sites in contemporary medicine are right now. And there are plenty, not enough personnel in medicine. The drug development somehow is a little bit stuck between the big drugs that we have gotten used to and the personalized medicine, which has a totally different approach. The advent of AI and technology, for that matter, altogether. So things are shifting in a rapid manner, right?
Yeah, they are shifting. And I think we're really at the cusp of change right now, I would say, when it comes to the future of medicine. So there are a number of technologies that are moving towards being realized, but they are not really being realized. So I think one example of that would be telemedicine, which of course is a certain buzzword and had like the baptism of fire during the COVID pandemic, when suddenly, of course, no one wanted to go to a doctor's office, and a lot of vulnerable people were also better off not going to a doctor's office. But thinking about this going towards the future could be a tremendously helpful technology, not to spend time on travel, to select a doctor irrespective of the location, and also to free time for the healthcare system. So a lot of benefits, but after the pandemic, actually, it was rolled back. This is one of the examples of technologies that could lead to a big change, but currently it's a little bit hard to predict how big this impact of these technologies will be. Similar, I mean, you already mentioned artificial intelligence, all this wearable technologies, smart sensors. So all of these like more technical aspects, they're currently really seeing a growth spurt, let's put it like that, but we don't know the real impact that they might have. So it might be that in the future we have a doctor who doesn't see patients anymore, but will only look at the data that the Apple Watch creates, or maybe the Apple Watch will already tell the person that you have a certain risk of heart disease or similar disease risks, where you could just not see a doctor at all and cut the doctor out of the loop and have the sensor, have the AI system take care of it all. Based on what we had from the Topol quote, I consider that highly unlikely that this will be the case. But of course, that would be one extreme possibility for the future of medicine, to have it fully technologized.
let's try an overview of the technological impact that is happening right now. I mean, we cover telemedicine and we cover the wearables that are somewhere between medical devices and fitness devices, one could say. But then again, both fields are interrelated anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, I mean, on the one hand, we have, I would call that the technologization of medicine, where machines take over jobs that humans used to do before. And this is a massive scope, can be surgical robots, can be also machines that really take care of more administrative tasks. I mean, we talk about that a lot for AI, that just freeing resources by having any kind of writing tasks, for example, or data sorting tasks being taken care of a machine learning algorithm rather than a human being. But there's also this element, as we said, of wearables, of smartwatches, of glucose sensors and similar. And then there's also the whole field of health apps, which could be really also, again, medical devices. It can also be lifestyle devices, and it's a little bit fluctuating where this could fall. Of course, I mean, if you want to have it as a medical device, it needs to be certified, of course. But having this as the technological foundation for the changes in medicine, and then having on top this layer of virtualization, so having doctor's visit that can happen via Zoom meeting or similar. So, of course, you need specialized software for that. You cannot just do it via Zoom, and there's some data privacy regulations. But then also having the readouts from all these sensors going into this interaction between the patient and the doctor. And this can be during general care, but this can also be during clinical research. And I think this is a really interesting arena for this change, because many trials actually fail. So when new treatments, new drugs are being tested, fail. And I think it's around 1/3 of trials that fail due to a lack of sufficient patient recruitment. So you don't get enough patients. And then this whole enterprise, which costs a lot of money, I mean, up to 500 million, but I mean, even for cheaper ones, it's above 1 million usually, it fails because you didn't find enough patients. And then having these more virtualized approaches where you, for example, could monitor patients from home, not having them come into the site visit, especially if we think about patients who might be a bit fragile or who are dispersed somewhere geographically, it can be really helpful to have this. And it's called decentralized trials approach, where you just measure them through some smart device or similar, and then read out the data. So this could really be a big time saver, but also take clinical research to another level, because you could be much more inclusive when it comes to populations that you want to integrate into these trials.
Yeah. Before we come to the what that means for healthcare professionals altogether, let's include the stage in which AI is right now. Maybe beginning with what is, as we speak, certified in AI? What is allowed to be done in the medical field with AI?
I mean, there are guidelines for the approval of artificial intelligence algorithms. There has also been the EU AI Act that has some additional requirements, for example, when it comes to the transparency of algorithms. In general, I think from the US Food and Drug Administration, you currently have around almost 900, or maybe by now a few more, approved algorithms. But interestingly, almost all, so 3/3 of them, are radiology image analysis algorithms. And this is the field where AI currently works really well. And then now we're getting newer applications, but radiology is really the success story still of AI in medicine.
Right, right. I mean, and that's the history of AI, you know, being the ability to have bulletproof analysis of pictures, right? And this is a use case in radiology, obviously.
At least for this newer technology of deep learning that comes from, like, since 2012 around, that was one of the bigger applications where it really had this aha moment where suddenly AI seemed to work. In terms of what's allowed, I mean, it falls under the medical device regulations once it's being used in patients. These can be, I mean, quite strict in terms of not, I mean, of course, not harming patients, but also in terms of privacy that needs to be assured for patients. So in Germany, we have some special medical device types, which are the DIGA, so digital, and DIPA, so digital health and digital care applications. And here also there was just a new data security standard released, which really makes sure that the patient data is not being misused or being, I mean, that it's really being secured. There was, and I think this is also one of the key risks and also the fears of people that use these apps, that the data just lands somewhere else and it's your personal health data, which of course, I mean, obviously is not what you want. And I mean, we know how unsafe data can be when we think, for example, about the Cambridge Analytics scandal with Facebook. And that can be very off-putting to patients, obviously, to know these data risks. Pretty old study from the NIH from 2015 showed, for example, that 20% of all health apps were not adhering to data security standards. I hope it's better by now, but I think, I mean, this is one of the key factors when we think about the digitization and, I mean, also the virtualization of healthcare, that the patient data, be it in conversation between a doctor and a patient in an electronic meeting, be it the data that is transmitted through your smartwatch to the doctor, that all of that is safe and not accessible to a third party. And this is extremely challenging when it comes to these sensors, because there are a lot of players involved. So it might be that, think about some kind of wearable smart device that measures your heart rate, that you have the tech company that created the hardware. It might be, I mean, in many cases, like for Apple, I think hardware and software come from the same source, but it might be that you have an additional software provider or app creator, you have the healthcare system, and you might even have another party involved. So on the one hand, securing all this data, but also making this data interoperable and knowing who owns this data at which point in time can be really challenging. And I think these are things where, despite the immense potential of these technologies, we're very far from having it solved. And I think this will be really the basis and the key need for implementing these technologies into the healthcare system.
And yet you found out that alone in the United States, 84 million people as of 2020 possessed and dealt with apps, health and healthcare related, and 200 million smartwatches worldwide. I guess by the second as we speak, this is amounting to larger sums of devices, of course. So on the one hand side, you would have the rightfully argued topic of data protection. On the other hand, the benefits of it. Politically, we have to figure out a way where and how to navigate those grounds, because it's, you will not get to the point where you have 100% safety. As you don't have if you go to surgery to the hospital, you don't have 100%, you know, therefore you sign documents, right, that there might be something going wrong. And same with data, I think. And we still have to come to our senses in that case, I guess.
Yeah, I think, I mean, here just defining what the error tolerance might be. But I think at the same time, for the developers taking all the steps required to protect the data as much as possible, I think is key. And I mean, it's very intransparent. We're dealing, I think there's also a huge global divide. We're dealing with big tech companies that are mostly not situated in Europe. And we know, I mean, all these discussions around telling Facebook or telling Amazon not to violate any human rights regulations. And they say, sure, we won't do it in the future. And then no one knows what's, I mean, right. It's very intransparent handling of data. And I think since big tech is heavily invested in this space, this is a tricky question. I think another thing, when you say, I mean, we need to assess the benefit. And I think this in general for any kind of preventative measure. And I think this is something that we haven't really touched upon, but I think that's really important, that many of these strategies, when it comes to implementing new technologies that constantly measure your health status and give updates, can of course be used as a preventative approach to medicine. So I think, and this is one of the key trends towards the future of medicine, not only repairing the broken parts of the machine, so the human body just needs to be fixed, but having an approach where you really prevent the parts from breaking into the future. This fits into this longevity science, understanding how the body works, and then keeping it working as good as possible. And this is very, very different from the current model of medicine.
Absolutely.
And this, of course, really can be bolstered by these kind of technologies that constantly give updates on glucose levels, on heart rate, on if you're older, for example, having gait sensors that give you a risk of falling, having facial recognition that show your risk of Alzheimer, having movement sensors, how you interact with the phone that might show you your risk of Parkinson's, all these things, I think can be very, very helpful. But at the same time, when it comes to these preventative measures, measuring the real impact is very, very difficult. And the same goes, for example, for genetic screening, which would also be part of such a preventative strategy, that you have already a risk profile for certain diseases, maybe even from birth or from a certain age, polygenic risk scores, but also single disease causing variants. So, I mean, there are many ideas around having newborn screening across the population. And I think this could, of course, be one idea for the future of medicine. But getting back to the original problem, measuring the real impact of preventative measures is very, very difficult. Because on the one hand, you need to say who benefits. Is it the population as a whole, or is it the individual patient? And does the patient benefit in the sense that a single patient can be saved? Which, of course, when you think about the aim of medicine, is what you want. But at the same time, you also need to balance it towards the costs of the healthcare system. Because if healthcare gets so expensive, because you spend $4 billion per patient to do anything possible to keep the patient as healthy as possible, then you don't have money for anyone else. And I think this is really a trade-off. And I think for these, for example, for screening strategies, I mean, there are cancer screens that are highly debated, for example, prostate cancer screening, where always they try to assess, are more lives saved or are more costs created by implementing these screens? And I think the same will be true for many of these preventative measures. Of course, in a perfect situation where you have all the money in the world, you could just consistently test anyone for anything and measure anything possible. But that might actually not be so helpful. And at the same time, we have the risk of false positives. And I mean, this is true, of course, for genetic screens, but it's also true for these sensors, for example, having a false alarm for having some kind of heart event from your Apple Watch will definitely get you to the ER and again, put strain on the healthcare system, but it will also put strain on you because you will feel very stressed about it. And I think having, I mean, these general false alarms are a huge problem with sensors. And if they are in the hands of the patient, I mean, this is also, for example, these ideas around for which diseases should you test yourself and for which ones would it be actually helpful to have a healthcare professional there who can put it into perspective. Would you want to be alone and know that you have ALS in a fatal form that might kill you in 5 years? Maybe it would be better to have someone who can put it in perspective together with you. And I think this is, I mean, for all these personalized devices that, of course, empower the patient. And I think this is extremely helpful to have the patient more literate and more understanding of their own health data, but it also carries risks when it comes to putting it into perspective.
All this touches upon the patient-centered approach to the future medicine that we have been discussing here and other places constantly is being discussed. And the question is always, also with the prediction and the prevention, the question that we will only know after we have practiced it for at least one generation. To see, because in intensive care costs some X and the prevention prediction costs some Y, you know, and before we have evidence about numbers, we can't even discuss the economics of this new approach, including the personalized medicine, right?
Absolutely. And I think this, I mean, in general, is a big challenge, but also when it comes to the acceptance of the patients. And I think the best example for this challenge are vaccines. It's very good to be vaccinated against any kind of infectious disease that you are likely to contract. Then you can start discussing how likely are you to contract this disease. At the same time, for a patient, or I mean, in this case, it's not a patient, right? It's a person who doesn't have a disease, but wants to prevent having this disease. And I think they're having, I mean, the understanding of how big the buy-in also from the population towards these measures can be is really exemplified on the situation of vaccines, with many people completely accepting it and are very happy that we don't get polio anymore, that we don't get smallpox anymore. This is amazing. But a lot of people also saying now, I don't want the standard childhood vaccinations, not even to talk about the evil COVID vaccines, because I don't know what I'm putting into my body. And I think for a lot of these preventative strategies, it will be exactly the same discussion. So I think this is really something where it's not only about technology and not only about costs, but also about the mindset of all the stakeholders, of the doctors, of the regulators, of the policymakers, and especially of the population who somehow need to be convinced of the usefulness of a measure that influences them. And for example, I mean, again, to the example of the genetic screening, often you have screens that benefit the population because you learn something about the disease, but it's anonymized. So as a single patient, you don't even know what you have. So you can decide, do I want to do something good for the community, even though I don't have any benefit from it? Or would I only do it if I will know something and get something out of it?
Izzy, let's get to the beginning, to the emotional intelligence, and that touches upon the field also of the future of HCPs, the healthcare professionals all together, because you would, on the one hand side, you would have the labor unions saying, oh my God, we're losing through technology, AI, and so forth. We're losing tens of thousands of jobs. The other side would be, okay, we have more free time to take care of patients and to show some empathy, to be closer to what we do at the very beginning when we choose a medical career, what we promise, or probably most of people have in mind when they decide for a career in the medical field. So what will the future of medicine really bring for healthcare professionals? I mean, we know for a fact that even now in Western Europe, where the populations are getting older and older, we lack personnel. So we need people. Of course, the technology could help, but even more so in the qualitative way, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure if AI will really get rid of so many jobs in the end. I mean, it was said 10 years ago for the radiologists and they are still thriving. They're still around. I think the humans will still be needed to interpret the results and put them into context and communicate them, I think, at least in the nearer future. And at the moment, I mean, as you say, the healthcare systems and the people who work in them are completely overburdened, not only by the classical tasks like taking care of patients or conducting clinical research or learning new things, but by really administrative tasks, which is not very helpful. So if the machines could take over those tasks, it would be extremely helpful. How the future will look like for future doctors and nurses is that they will, even if they will not be replaced by machines, they will have to learn to collaborate with machines. I think this is a key part. And therefore, you need a large amount of digital literacy. So you need to understand, if you work together with an AI algorithm, for example, to derive a diagnosis or a drug dose, or even if you have your notes taken by the algorithm, I mean, you need to understand how this algorithm works, and you need to be able to explain it to a patient in order to enhance the trust or even build the trust. I mean, there was a recent study showing that patients, if they perceive a diagnosis being or a perceived interaction involving AI, even though it didn't, they lose the trust in it, in the medical system at the current stage. For me, it would actually be the other way around, because I would feel like if it involves AI, probably it has more data to corroborate it. So I think it could, or even for image analysis, if you have these quick screens and someone looks at your, I don't know, your moles for like 1 second and says it's not skin cancer, I would actually not mind having AI involved to right. Be a little bit more thorough. Yeah, I think. And I mean, here, really, the merging of human and machine intelligence will be important. And I think, as this quote from Topol in the beginning, the humans then will have to take over the emotional part of digesting the data towards a patient in a way that the patient understands it. And I think there's another really big point here, which is the communication. And we discussed about that a lot in the episode on polygenic risk scores. These are often very complex connections, especially when it comes to preventative medicine. I mean, they're can be risks. What does a 10% risk of contracting a disease in your lifetime, what does that actually mean for you? So here, really having smart ways to communicate these complexities to the patient can be very helpful. And it has been shown that patients who know their data, their genetic data, but also, for example, have these smart device measurements of, for example, heart rate, step count, etc., will improve their health-promoting behavior. So they will walk more, they will eat better, they will take their medication. So in the end, integrating these technological advances with a human component can lead patients to improve their behaviors. And this is, of course, what we want to aim for. I think another thing that healthcare professionals really need to focus on is interdisciplinarity, working together with people from other professions, not only throughout medicine, but also integrating this more technological aspects and understanding better what the needs of the patients are. And I think a last point maybe might be that healthcare professionals of the future should really, when it comes to these technological trends in medicine, show a certain resilience, because there will be massive trends and they are very fast paced. And this is something that we're discussing with AI a lot. So we have these movements that back in the days might have taken 20 or 30 years. Suddenly they happen in the span of 2 years or less, thinking about ChatGPT, for example, and being able to adapt quickly and use the tools, but also be a little bit resilient to those technology hypes. I mean, we might remember IBM's Watson as a medical tool that made some ludicrous predictions along the way and needed in the end, it actually did not have a positive impact. So here, really knowing the benefits and the limits of the technologies. And again, this brings us back to the digital literacy. One needs to have enough understanding to know how to interact with the technology to get the best out of it. And I think this will be very important.
So lifelong learning, not as a hobby anymore, but for real. That's for sure for all those involved in the medical field in the future. Let us hear one, two sentences about the demand for infrastructure for the medicine of the future, especially here in Western Europe, where we lack some understanding, maybe to put it pretty polite in comparison to other world regions when it comes to technology.
I think this is a problem across the board. I mean, on the one hand, of course, simple things like a stable internet connection that is not a given anywhere, at least across Germany. If you go to Northern Europe, I think it looks very different. But also having just data standards that are interoperable. So having data that no matter where, in which hospital, which healthcare provider you are located, you can use, having APIs, so having connections between systems and data that can work together. I think these are really the basic basics. And they are needed because, I mean, if you for every project have to reinvent the wheel, and I think this is something that's currently often happening out of necessity because the standards are not there yet, this will be very, very difficult for healthcare systems to really make the full use of the potential of this data. And at the same time, I think, I mean, this a little bit harsher regulations that we have in Europe might also play to our benefit in certain extents, because I think it might enhance a little bit the trust and the buy-in of the patient. At the same time, when it comes to both the data collection as well as the artificial intelligence, I mean, it's massively centralized in the United States at the moment with a little bit of China as well. But I think here we're really lagging behind. And I don't know if this is something, I mean, because it's irrespective of healthcare that can be fixed easily. But I think it also doesn't mean that Europe should give up on it. I think it means that maybe finding your way to work in certain niches and really try to make the best of the situation that we have here with, of course, also very divergent healthcare systems and models and very different standards all across Europe. At the same time, there are a lot of very interesting EU projects when it comes to working together to share knowledge across these different systems and make the best of it could be really a winning system for the future.
Very, very interesting, Izzy. And of course, where technology is strong, it's getting a little colder, so we need more with every acting person, emotional intelligence that we mentioned at the very beginning of this episode.
Absolutely.
Many, many thanks, Izzy. This is so amazing. And I think that we can break out every single piece of what we've discussed today and make another episode of it, because everything is worthwhile discussing, and really looking forward to that. Thank you for now.
Thank you.
This was We're Doomed, We're Saved on the future of medicine. Quite interesting. If you have any feedback, please let us know at sciencetales.com. We're also open for new topics, new themes. Of course, we like if you subscribe to the show and you like it. We're looking forward to hear from you, and you will hear from us again pretty soon next month.